Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
Good evening. There's three people away. Good evening. It is great to be with you, and I hope you've had a blessed day. I appreciate very much Brother Rick leading us before the throne of God. And while we've got him up here, I appreciate so much all the work that he puts in to make things happen for CBI. There's a million things he does as far as getting things ready and recording and make sure that the Wi-Fi is working and we get things back out, get recorded and get back out to those that participate in CBI, and just one of the many, many, many people that work very hard and make a difference to make this happen. Thank you for what you are doing. Can you believe this is the 19th year of CBI? Is anybody besides me? Dan and I were kind of talking about things for this year several months back, and we're like, is this already 19? And this is already 4 years that Dan and I have been putting that together, and it's just kind of mind-boggling to me to think that we are on the doorstep of our 20th anniversary. And that's made possible because of all the people in this room, and just thank you for doing that. So I'm excited to be back for that. I bring greetings from Cindy and Katie and Hannah. And although you actually probably see Cindy more than you see me because she's in and out of town working over at primary eye care and so forth. And so she talks about running into several of you, especially when they have their sales and so forth. But they send you their love and their greetings. I will tell you that I'm actually not here for CBI. I'm here because the local Columbia police have called Freed Hardeman University and said that there are two refugees here who are causing a lot of trouble. That there's a Hoyt Kirk and a Monty Tatum, refugees from Henderson, Tennessee, who are regularly on the police scanner and police reports, and they've asked if I would come and help their wives and do something about them. So, I just wanted you to know what my real reason for being here is, and it's great to see them and their wives. You can feel the love. Can you feel the love tonight? I'm going to sing to you. I want you to think about, now, no, you're not allowed to speak, Tony. Somebody please put a rag in his mouth. Okay. But I love you, brother. But I am grateful to be with you, to be with family, to be with friends in God's kingdom. I want you to think about the power of a name. Think about times in a marriage when you have struggles. Times when you have those mountains you have to climb. You have your ups and your downs. And so I want you, if you're married, to think about some of the struggles that you went to as a married couple. And I just want to share with you one of the most tense moments in the 28 years that Cindy Brothers has endured a marriage with me. And that was when we were trying to name our first child. Now, I want you to remember going through that process of trying to name your children. I don't know if it was like that for you, but we would sit down and start talking about it, or we'd be driving down the road and one of us had been reading from one of those baby name books, or we'd been looking online for names. And yes, they did have online searches back then, but we were looking and thinking about names and what we might want to do. And so I remember distinctly on occasion after occasion as we talked about what the names might be, generally 95% of the time, Cindy left those discussions depressed because she thought the names I picked out were terrible names. And so we would throw out names. I usually thought about, like, I wanted some name that was connected to the Bible or some name that was connected to family history. She was more concerned with, did it sound good? And was it a name that there were a lot of other people that had that particular name? And sometimes it was about what was connected to that name. For example, if there was somebody she knew that was really mean who had that name, or somebody she used to date, which wasn't a great experience. Well, that we're not naming our son by that name. And I remember one time, like my mom and dad are here tonight, and my dad's name is Joe, and on her side of the family, she has a grandfather named Joseph, and her brother's name is Joey, and my name is Kirk. And so I came up with this brilliant idea, said, if we have a son, for those of you who don't know me, I have two daughters, daughters. But at that time, we didn't know. And so I said, if we had a son, what about Joseph Kirk? That gets both sides of the family. I get to pass on my name. That is a win-win situation. She said, well, if you name him Joseph Kirk, then they're going to shorten it to Joe Kirk, and then it's going to become Joker, and he's going to be known as a Joker the rest of his life. So, neither one of my girls are named Joseph Kirk. So, I want you to think about that. Names are significant. And think about the thought that you put into the naming of your children. In the Jewish culture in particular, the naming of a child was very, very important. For male children, they usually weren't named till the eighth day when they were circumcised. So, there was some time to think about it. There was time, for example, to think about the events surrounding the birth. And there was also an opportunity. After 8 days, you already begin to see a little bit of a child's personality. And so sometimes that would come into play. Or a family would name their child based on their hopes and dreams for them. Or a lot of times, if you go through the kings of ancient Israel, you could tell whether or not the parents of that king followed the Lord faithfully by whether or not they put the name of God in the name of their son, or whether sometimes they put the name of a false god in the name of their son. The reason I mention that is this week we're focusing on the theme of from Saul to Paul. And we're looking at a transformation that took place in a life that is embodied in a transformation from one name to another name. And as we kick off that focus this week on Paul and his teaching and his life and his theology, and then look at a lot of different practical areas of our walk with God, of how we can continue the work that Jesus passed on to Paul and several others, and ultimately on to us, I want tonight to focus on the biblical bullseye that the name says it all. The name says it all. As we think about from Saul to Paul. I'd like to begin tonight in Acts chapter 11. My focus is going to be Acts chapter 13, but I want to begin in Acts chapter 11, looking around verse 19. In the first part of this lesson tonight, I would like to talk about the city of the commission. Then I'd like to transition over to the change in condition. The city of the commission and the change in the condition. So as we talk about the city of commission, I'm focusing primarily on the city of Antioch. And that story begins back in Acts chapter 11. You may recall that in Acts chapter 7, a deacon or a leader in the church in Jerusalem by the name of Stephen was stoned to death. The first four or five verses of Acts chapter 8 tell us that a wholesale persecution broke out against the Lord's church. And around verse 4 tells us as those Christians fled Jerusalem, literally running for their lives, they went everywhere preaching the gospel. Now as we get into the middle of Acts chapter 11, You've just completed the conversion of Cornelius and his family, and then the reaction to that by the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. And now what happens is Luke, the author of the book of Acts, is going to return to that theme that is at the beginning of Acts chapter 8, of what is happening as those persecuted Christians scattered across the Roman Empire. And so the text says, as they were scattered everywhere they went, they're sharing the gospel and they're planting congregations. What I want us to notice is in verse 20 and 21 of Acts chapter 11, the text tells us that some of those Christians, remember, if you go back to Acts chapter 2, there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven that were there on the day of Pentecost, and 3,000 were converted to Christ. Some would have been from Jerusalem. Others would have been from all over the Roman Empire. We also know from the end of Acts chapter 2 that they seem to have stayed in Jerusalem for quite some time. And so you had people from all over the world living in Jerusalem. And so when this scattering takes place, you have people who, some of them were from Jerusalem, others were from other parts of the world and just living in Jerusalem. And so they just are going to scatter to the winds and spread the gospel everywhere they go. The text tells us here in Acts chapter 11, verses 20 and 21, that there were some men from Cyprus and Cyrene. Cyrene is an island. We'll pull up look at it just a few moments. You can see it actually on the picture above us. If you look at the island that is just to the right of our scripture reading, that is the Isle of Cyprus. That's where Barnabas was from. And it was an island at about 150 miles away from Antioch. You have Cyrene. You may think of the crucifixion of Jesus, and a man named Simon of Cyrene was responsible for carrying the cross of Jesus. It is a city that was in North Africa, hundreds of miles away from Antioch. And so these folks are going to converge on the city of Antioch in Syria. You've got two key Antiochs named after Antiochus, one of the former rulers of this part of the world. But you've got Antioch of Syria, and then there's also an Antioch of Pisidia that Paul is going to visit on his first missionary journey. But we're concerned with Antioch of Syria, which is up north of Jerusalem, north of Israel and Judea, north of the Sea of Galilee. And it's a very, very important city. This city of Antioch was the third largest metropolitan city in the Roman Empire. The only two cities that were larger than it were Alexandria in Egypt and Rome itself. It was a city of 500,000 people. You will find consistently that as the gospel was spread across the globe, they often targeted large metropolitan centers, and then the gospel would filter from those larger cities down into the smaller communities. Now, as we think about what's happening here, I want us to go back to Acts chapter 1 and verse 8 and see the progression of the gospel. If we go back to Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, you basically have Luke's version of the Great Commission. We think of that from Mark chapter 16, verses 15 and 16, or we think about Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 through 20. All of these are from the lips of Jesus. But a particular statement from the lips of Jesus that embodies that same commission to take the gospel across the globe is found in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8. This is where Jesus is giving the commission to His apostles. He's giving them their marching orders. He says, "You are going to be witnesses." You notice, if you look at the end of Acts chapter 1, that to be an apostle, to be one sent personally, handpicked by Jesus, you had to have been a witness, have to have experienced His life from the time of His baptism to His ascension back into heaven. To be a witness means that we have experienced something. We've seen something, we've heard something, we've touched something, and we are sharing, giving testimony about that which we have experienced. And so what He's saying to these men is, you've experienced My life, you have experienced My death and My resurrection, you've seen My miracles, you've heard My teaching, now I need you to go testify to the world about what you have witnessed. And He gives them a specific plan for how that is to happen. And that plan that He gives in Acts chapter 1 and verse 8 is the outline of the book of Acts. He says, I want you to be witnesses starting in Jerusalem, then I want you to go to Judea and Samaria, and then I want you to go to the remotest parts of the earth. And from that moment forward, He then tells how, having called these witnesses, how different witnesses stepped to the witness stand and testified about Jesus, and the gospel consistently goes to new people groups. It starts with the Jews in Acts chapter 2. It then goes to Samaritans, Jews who intermarried with those from other nations in the aftermath of the destruction of the northern kingdom by Assyria and the southern kingdom of Judah by Babylon in the Old Testament. And so out of those intermarriages, you had the Samaritan race. And so the gospel goes to them. In Acts chapter 8, at the end of Acts chapter 8, you have a eunuch from Ethiopia who I believe is a foreigner who was a complete proselyte to Judaism, as signified from the fact that he was willing to travel 1,000 miles from his homeland to Jerusalem. I think it gives evidence of his full conversion. You have God-fearing Gentiles who adopted the God of the Old Testament, who adopted the morality of the Old Testament, but didn't completely buy everything in the Old Testament. They didn't observe the sacrificial system or the food laws, and they weren't circumcised. I think that probably what is going on here with the eunuch is you have a circumcised non-Jew who proselytized, completely converted to Christianity. But then what happens in Acts chapter 10 is you have the first uncircumcised Gentile, the first uncircumcised non-Jew. And then in chapter 11, you start having whole congregations of uncircumcised non-Jews. And that is embodied here by the church that was at Antioch. With that background in place to think about how this congregation started, let's leapfrog forward a couple of chapters to Acts chapter 13. It says in 13 verse 1, "Now there were at Antioch and the church that was there prophets and teachers." And it says Barnabas and Simeon, who was called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene, and Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. I want you to just kind of look. One of the fascinating things, you look at the list of these five teachers and leaders in the church at Antioch. It was a very eclectic congregation. And it is really a picture of what the church ought to be. It was a congregation literally made up of people all over the world. And so if you were to go and visit this congregation, you would see all dialects. You would see all skin colors. You've literally people from all walks of life. And so as we look at this list of these five names, I just wanted to kind of highlight that. You can see that. If y'all go one more slide, you can just see that in these names and where they came from. You've got Latin names. You've got Jewish names. You've got people from literally all over, from hundreds of miles apart, who are all brought together in this beautiful, eclectic congregation at Antioch. You've got Barnabas. Barnabas is actually a nickname. It's not his name. And so you've got a nickname here, and he is a wealthy Jewish man who was from Cyprus, that island I talked about, but had been living in recent years in Jerusalem. You've got Simeon, and that is a name we're familiar with, a very common name. You think of many in the New Testament that went by that name. And so, in fact, that's probably why he's referred to as Simeon the Black, to differentiate him from several others who went by the name, so you know which one he was talking about. And I want to emphasize that as we think about skin color here, that probably most of the people we're talking about were all darker skinned than those of us in the audience who might be Caucasian. It's just that Simeon would have been a little darker skinned than those who were already darker skinned than most of us are. You've got Lucius. That's a Roman name, and he is from that from Cyrene, which is that village in North Africa. You got Manaen, who grew up as the foster brother of Herod Antipas, the one who killed John the Baptist. He would also have been the foster brother of Herod Philip. And so he grew up in royalty. And so you've got literally folks from all walks of life. And then you've got Saul, who is from Tarsus, a city that is 100, 150 miles up north of the city of Antioch, up in the area, the southern end of Asia Minor. So he's from Tarsus, a city that is really in a lot of ways like ancient Athens, with all kinds of philosophers and pagan idol worshiping, etc., who then also grew up in Jerusalem in the heart of Judaism. And his name, Saul, is a Jewish name. So, I mean, you've got Roman names, you've got Jewish names, you've got people from North Africa, you've got people from islands in the Mediterranean, you've got folks from up in Asia Minor, folks from Jerusalem. Literally, this collection of people from all over the world. Now, what I'm especially interested in is how we end up with the one that is at the top of the list and the bottom of the list there, Barnabas and Saul. How do they end up being a part of this group? To understand that, we need to back up again to chapter 11. We go back to chapter 11. The apostles hear that the gospel has gone to this third largest city in the Roman Empire of Antioch, and they understand the significance of this. This is a big deal. And so since you've got new congregations and new Christians in this very, very important city, they felt it necessary to send somebody to build up these new Christians and build up the church there. Well, who do you send to encourage new Christians? Well, you send an encourager. Because if we were to go back to the end of Acts chapter 4, we would run into a guy named Joseph. Again, another very common name in the New Testament. And the apostles gave this guy named Joseph a nickname. His nickname was Barnabas, the son of encouragement. He was one who sold property and gave it to the apostles to help those Christians who were in need. He was a person whose life was spent focusing on others, caring for others, building up others, encouraging others. So when the apostles were trying to think about, well, who can we send to encourage these new Christians? Let's send the encourager. And so if we look in Acts chapter 11, verses 22 and 23, that's what they did. And the text says, when he arrived, he did exactly what his name said he would do. He began to encourage them because he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and faith. And because of his preaching and the power of God, many, many people were brought to Jesus Christ. Now, to explain how Saul becomes a part of the equation, we need to look in verse 26 of Acts chapter 11. The apostles send Barnabas to preach to this new congregation, these new Christians in Antioch. Barnabas had met a young man by the name of Saul. Their encounter was back in Acts chapter 9, maybe somewhere around verse 27, when Saul was converted in Damascus, and some years later, some 3 years later at least, he travels to Jerusalem for the first time. When he gets there, because he's been responsible for the imprisonment and death of many of the Christians in the local congregations, they weren't terribly excited about him sitting in on their worship services. And so they didn't want to associate with him. I just imagine that maybe Saul imprisoned your brother, or he was responsible for the stoning death of your mother and your father. How would you like to sit down in Sunday morning Bible class and find him sitting down at the end of the pew? Would not be the most exciting Bible class for you. So you can understand why they were reluctant to just kind of accept him with open arms. It was Barnabas who turned the tide. Barnabas, if you will, the usher for the congregation there, he went to him, introduced him to some of the apostles, told people what good things he was doing, how he had changed, and the preaching that he was doing in the name of God. And if you will, as they say, the rest is history. And so sometime later, when he's now, many years later, when he's now, Barnabas, working with the church at Antioch, he thinks, I need some help here. Where can I get someone who would be good to come and help me work with this young new church? He remembers that young man that he welcomed to the church in Jerusalem. And so he travels north up to Tarsus in Cilicia, and he brings Saul down to work with him in this new congregation. And so that's how Saul and Paul ended up working together at the church at Antioch. And they worked together for about a year. And so when we get to the beginning of Acts chapter 13, you've got these five teachers who are the primary teachers for the congregation at Antioch. But we find in verse 2 that the Holy Spirit tells the leaders there at Antioch to set apart Paul and Barnabas for a very special work. And we're reminded of something that as we go through the book of Acts, you'll see over and over that Jesus and the Holy Spirit are guiding everything that's happening in the book. God is very much in charge. And so Paul and Barnabas are to go forth and share the gospel. So you begin to see the fulfilling of that portion of the Great Commission where the gospel is to go to the ends of the earth. It's been to Jerusalem, to Judea and Samaria. Now it's going to go to the remotest parts of the earth because of the city, the congregation of Antioch that made the Great Commission their mission. And it doesn't surprise me that they ended up being the congregation to do that because they were a congregation of people from all over the world. And because of that, they had a very specific awareness that there was a world outside of lost people. They knew there were people back from their homes and their villages that didn't know Jesus Christ. And they wanted to make sure that the gospel got to those people. So, in Acts 13, chapter 13 and verse 4 and following, you're going to find that Paul and Barnabas and their team head out on what we commonly call the first missionary journey. They're going to go to Seleucia, and then they're going to travel over to the Isle of Cyprus. It shouldn't surprise us that they would go to the Isle of Cyprus first, because that's where Barnabas is from. He would have known the local people, even known places to stay. He would have had connections. That would be a great place to kick off this missionary journey that they are going to do together. And they would start preaching in the synagogues. You've got people that are gathered every Sabbath day to study the law, so that's a great place to start your teaching. So if you were to look at this map here, they travel 16 miles over to Seleucia, which is the port city for Antioch. They travel then about 140 miles. Karen, good luck with all of these names. I am so very sorry. All right, and travels about 140 miles over then to Cyprus. And then they're going to travel from Seleucia, which was the largest city, over then to the west coast, to the city that is actually the capital city of this region. There they're going to encounter a proconsul. In the Roman Empire, they had 10 kind of original colonies, if you will, kind of like think of our 13 original colonies. They were the colonies that were the oldest and most faithful, and they were called the senatorial provinces. You then also had imperial provinces. They were really like occupied territory. They weren't necessarily crazy about the empire, but they were held in subjection by the might and military of the empire. The senatorial provinces, the ones that were most faithful to the empire, were led by proconsuls. Those imperial occupied territory provinces were led by governors and generals. And so Cyprus was its own province, and it was led by a proconsul, and his name is Sergius Paulus. He also had a right-hand man, a wise man, a magician, a charlatan, who, even though Sergius Paulus is described as an intelligent man, he was able to be led astray by this guy who was one of his confidants and advisors. It's interesting that Elymas is described as Bar-Jesus, literally son of Jesus or son of Joshua, which is very, very ironic in the story in which we're talking about the power of names. And he was seeking to turn the proconsul away from Jesus Christ. I want to shift then for the last few moments from talking about the city of the commission to the change in a condition. Because what happens when you look in verse 9, it says, but Saul, when it's talking about who is going to lead the Bible study, when you think about what a big deal this is, they're having a Bible study with a Roman proconsul. Okay? This is a big, big deal. It's interesting though that Saul is the one who's going to be the spokesperson. Saul is the one who is going to lead the study. Now it says Saul, who is also called Paul. This is the first time in the text that he's introduced by his name Paul. Having multiple names was common in the ancient world, but generally among the Greeks and the Jews, they only went by one name. Now his name is Saul, Paul, who we're focusing on in this lesson. He tells us in the book of Philippians that he's from the tribe of Benjamin. One of the most famous people from the tribe of Benjamin would have been the first king of Israel, whose name was Saul. So basically, he's likely named after the most famous or one of the most famous members of his tribe. Some say that he started going by the name Paulus because he adopted the name of the proconsul that he had this Bible study with. That's a little bit odd. It was common in the ancient world when you had a teacher-student relationship for the student to adopt the name of the teacher. It was extremely unusual for the teacher to adopt the name of the student. Now we know that Paul was a Roman citizen, and Paul talks about that. Also, we know that a person who was a Roman citizen, well, first of all, we know that Paul was born a Roman citizen, and a person could become a Roman citizen, for example, we think likely a couple of ways he might have become a Roman citizen was if somebody in his family did a favor for one of the Roman emperors, and we have contact between at least three Roman emperors, for example, Mark Antony and Pompey, at least three leaders of Rome had special contacts and gave special blessings to people in the city of Tarsus where Paul was from, and so it may have come through that route. I think there's a really good chance that Paul had a father, a grandfather, somebody in his family line that was a former slave that was freed. Because if you go back to Acts chapter 6, when he was talking about the people who had the conflict with Stephen, which ultimately led to his stoning death, it says they were from the synagogue of the freedmen in Jerusalem. And that there were people in that synagogue of the freedmen who were from Cilicia. Tarsus, where Saul grew up, is from Cilicia. And it's interesting then that they were the ones who played a key role in the argument with Stephen, brought the accusations against Stephen, which resulted in the stoning of Stephen, and those who stoned Stephen laid their coats at the feet of a man named Saul, who's from Tarsus in Cilicia. And so it would then explain his connection to this synagogue of the freedmen. Because in the Roman culture, if you were a slave of a person with Roman citizenship and you were freed, you automatically got Roman citizenship and then adopted the name of the person who was the patron who freed you. And do I know that's how he got his name? No, but at least makes sense in light of Acts chapter 6. So he would have been born with the name Paul. In fact, Roman citizens had three different names. They had a praenomen, a nomen, and a quodnomen. And you never have all three of them listed anywhere in the New Testament. You have two places where the last two forms of name are mentioned. First one is kind of a formal name. The middle one is kind of your family clan. And the third one is more of a personal name, a nickname, what you more went by on a daily basis, such as the name of Paul. So he would have been born with that name. He leads the Bible study. In that Bible study, again, have a play on names, because remember, Elymas, who is the one who's trying to lead the emperor away from God, Elymas is called the son of Jesus. But notice who Saul or Paul calls him. He calls him the son of the devil. And the opposite of John the Baptist, who paved the way and made the path straight for the coming of Jesus, Elymas made the paths crooked. He made a crooked road. I'm convinced he must have been the one who made the roads that run through East Tennessee over about Knoxville, if you've ever tried to travel down those windy roads. But that's what he made for the spreading of the gospel. It's interesting that the Apostle Paul, as he's trying to stop Elymas from influencing the Roman proconsul, he strikes him with blindness from God. Why is that ironic? What was it that opened Paul's spiritual eyes? Acts chapter 9 tells us that it was being struck with blindness. The proconsul believed, and I won't go into detail, but there is evidence from the archaeological work of Sir William Ramsay that he may have had a daughter that was a Christian and may have passed Christianity on to his family. Something powerful happens here in Acts chapter 13. The text says that Paul and his companions... Up to this point, it had been Barnabas and Saul, Barnabas and Saul, Barnabas and Saul. We saw it in chapter 11, chapter 12, and the beginning of chapter 13. But here things change. In the last three times they're referred to in Acts chapter 13, it's Saul and his companions, or Paul and his companions, Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas. And Paul takes the lead, and he starts going uniquely by the name of Paul. The question naturally arises, why this change? I want you to think of the significance of the power of the change of a name. I have a foster brother and sister, and we tried for years to adopt them, but were not able to. But finally, when he turned 16 years old, my little brother, Jason, legally changed his name to Brothers. We were never able to adopt him, so he adopted us. And so he will die with a different name than he was born with. And it was symbolic of a change in his life. That is what's happening here. And as we think about the change that is taking place here, why is it that he may have stopped going by the name of Saul and started going by the name of Paul? Well, some folks say it's because the name Saul would have been crude in Greek. You see, the Greek word solos is a word that referred to the seductive walk of a woman who was a prostitute. And so, as he spoke Greek and wrote in Greek, the use of his name would have had inappropriate connotations that he might have wanted to avoid. Others think it may not have been because it would have been crude as he begins to use it in the Greek culture, but it was symbolic of the change in his life. That he had left his old style of life. He was no longer the one who in Judaism had been a persecutor of Christians, but now was devoted to Jesus Christ and a follower of the one he once persecuted. Some say it's because he has a new cause. Because now on, the purpose of his life is going to be sharing the gospel with those in the Greek culture. And as he traveled throughout the Roman Empire, his new cause, his new mission, though he had actually been working among the Greeks and Romans for years, but because of this special commission from God, it was just more appropriate to use his Roman name as he traveled through the Roman world. The name says it all. As we think about the change in Paul's name, I want us to think about a change in our name. You see, if you go back to Acts chapter 11, where the church at Antioch was established, you'll find that if you look there in verse 26, it says the disciples, the followers of Jesus, were first called Christians at Antioch. There was a name change. And just as Saul went from a name change of Saul to Paul, a critical moment in his life and his ministry. So each of us, when we became a Christian, we changed our name from sinner, from lost, from enemy of God, to child, to saved, to follower of this King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We took on the name Christian. And because of that name Christian, we ought to live differently. We ought to do differently. We ought to be differently. You see, just as it may have been because of crudeness that he quit going by the name of Saul, so it should be that because I am now a child of the King, there ought to be a change in my lifestyle to live up to the fact that I am now a brother of the Christ and a child of the Creator of the world. That I ought to live differently because of my new status. That I ought to be changed because I'm not what I used to be anymore. Just as he was not a persecutor anymore, I shouldn't be what I used to be before Christ. And because my cause ought to be different from this moment forward. That I no longer live for myself, but I now live for Jesus. Just as Paul thought, everything has changed. I have a new name. I need a new knife. So we need to recognize that when we were immersed in the waters of baptism, we didn't just take on a name change. There was supposed to be a lifestyle change that went along with it. One of my favorite stories